That adoration is a drug. It blinds you. It cripples you. It's insidious. It's a virus. It doesn't just intoxicate you, but it actually ends up bringing toxicity to the lives of all of those around you because it becomes all about you.
What's up, guys? So today's episode of Sauna Sessions is an amazing guest. She is a spiritual leader. She lives in Rishikesh, India. She has for 26 years. She's a speaker. She's a best-selling author. And she's also a PhD. Her name is Sadhvi. And you're going to really love this episode. Check it out. So thank you for being here. This is a interesting location to have an interview. You said you sauna occasionally when you travel.
I love it. I love steam rooms. Yeah. I love saunas. I don't do them very frequently, obviously, but I travel a lot and I'm at a lot of different conferences in different parts of the world with the United Nations or Religions for Peace or different big organizations and frequently, the hotel that we'll be staying at or that the conference is at will have a fitness center or spa that has a sauna or a steam room. And so if I've got a free hour, 2 hours or so, I will.
Do you do it for like the relaxation or do you do it for like some health benefits? Because I know there's a lot of studies on, you know, mortality rates and curing certain things and the detoxification of the body in the sauna. Why do you do it?
Well, that's interesting. I didn't know all of the health specifics. I knew, of course, yes, it's good for you. I mean, there's definitely energy around it as a health thing. I do it just because it feels really good. I have to say I prefer the steam to the sauna.
Yeah.
It's definitely more difficult to sit in. I don't think I could do this interview sitting in a steam room.
Okay.
But as far as if you've got 20 minutes or half an hour to go and experience their spa.
Yeah.
I'm much more likely to be lying in the steam room. Okay.
Lewis
than
said the same thing. Lewis Howes, he loves the steam. I've never done it.
It's wonderful. There's a feeling, you know, here you sit in here long enough and eventually you sweat. Whereas in the steam room, you go in and you're essentially drenched from the beginning. So there's definitely much more of this felt sense of detoxification, of purification, of release of whatever's being held in the cells of the body.
Yeah, I'm going to try it. So Sadhvi, I wanted to ask you a question. Everybody we meet has, you know, loved someone and lost someone. And so my question is, what are we doing here? Why are we here? What's the purpose of this human experience?
Beautiful. According to the Vedic tradition and the Vedic spirituality, we believe in reincarnation. That the soul is going to keep taking different forms until it actually has its ultimate awareness, experience of the truth of the self. Now, just to jump deeper right away, that in and of itself is actually a bit of a misnomer because we don't actually believe in individual souls. It's not, oh, your soul over there in your body, my soul over here in my body. It's actually soul that is taking, due to different karmic experiences, different karmic journeys, different karmic packages, is taking different forms temporarily. The easiest way to think about it is an ocean. One ocean, many waves. The waves are real. So people will say things like, this existence is an illusion. Maya. Now that's true on the deepest level, but it doesn't mean that my physical body is an optical illusion. It doesn't mean that this is not real. It is real, which is why we practice compassion and love and care. I mean, if none of it were real at all, why love? Why have compassion? Why have kindness? The reality is in this concept of waveforms and oceans. So if you've got a wave in the ocean, now, is it real? Of course it's real. If you don't think it's real, go out and try to swim in it, and you're going to find yourself face down with a mouthful of sand and gasping for breath. Mm. It's absolutely real, but it's not the highest truth. The highest truth is ocean.
Mm. Okay.
See, the wave is there. It's real. You couldn't say it's an illusion. But even while the wave is there, which is a higher truth? If you're looking at the wave and you want to describe the wave, or someone says, what is that? Well, you could say either that is wave or that is ocean.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they're both true, but wave is what you could call lowercase t true, as in at this exact intersection of time and space, that wave has come into form. But the capital T truth, the eternal truth, is ocean. Because that which is in the wave was ocean long before it was a wave, will be ocean after the wave no longer exists. Mm. And even while the wave exists, it no longer stops being ocean. Mm. If you take a spoonful or a dropperful of water from a wave, and you take it to a science laboratory, and you look at it under a microscope, the scientist is not going to say wave. Mm-hmm. The scientist is going to say ocean.
Mm.
In the same way, our highest truth is soul. Like the wave's highest truth is ocean, our highest truth is soul.
One soul.
One soul.
Is there a difference between soul and spirit?
You know, I really personally try to avoid the semantics.
Okay.
And the reason being that these come from terms that are Sanskrit to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
We speak about Atma.
Yeah.
Jivatma, Paramatma. Jivatma is my individual soul.
Mm-hmm.
Paramatma is the supreme soul.
Mm.
Now, Jivatma, the individual soul, is the one soul as it intersects with this karmic package.
Mm.
As long as it is manifesting in and through this physical body, this set of circumstances, we'll call it Jivatma. Like we'll call that wave.
Mm-hmm.
But it never stopped being oceans.
Mm.
And if knowing that you are soul,
mm-hmm.
is the path that works for you, fantastic.
Mm.
If soul and spirit feel a little bit too like out there,
just words.
But you can connect to love in you, fantastic. Mm. It's a beautiful path.
Mm.
If you are a religious person and connecting to the divine within you, to God within you works, beautiful, by all means. The concept of just consciousness works.
Mm.
Use that path.
Mm.
Doesn't matter what path.
Mm.
It's all about getting in. You know, we live on the banks of this sacred Ganga, Ganges River, this bringer. I mean, Ganga is the goddess who's the bestower of liberation.
Mm-hmm.
The point is to get in. Doesn't matter whether you get in by the marble steps at Parmarth Nikathon or you get in some other way.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter. So we're here on earth, as you asked, to remember. This is all coming back to your question. To remember the truth of who we are.
Mm.
We are here as a wave to remember that we are ocean.
Wow.
While simultaneously being the absolute best wave we can be.
Hmm.
A lot of people think that a spiritual path is all about pushing away our waveness, pushing away the individuality, pushing away the concept of the body, the karmic package, the dharma, and it should only be about soul.
Hmm.
But it's not. the purpose of why we're here is to remember, to realize, to know that we are soul, and to honor and celebrate the karmic journey that this reflection of the cosmic soul has, that has taken a perfect birth in this perfect container with all of its perfect struggles and suffering and conflicts in order to have its perfect remembrance and awareness and realization and opening and expansion, and whether we say self-realization or God realization or nirvana or moksha or enlightenment. Again, it's all semantics.
Yeah, I think it was Alfred Korzybski wrote a book called General Semantics a long time ago. And one of the quotes that always stuck out to me was, the map is not the territory.
Yes.
The map is
or
not
the treasure.
Oh, I love that one.
The X is not the treasure chest.
Yeah. For people who may not get that, it's like if you wanted to go to, I'm from St. Louis. So say you wanted to go to St. Louis and you're driving to St. Louis and you come to a sign that says, here is St. Louis. Or you're in, so welcome to St. Louis. And you say, oh, I got to St. Louis. I can leave now. Well, you didn't quite get there because, you know, the map, the sign is not it, right? It's just a pointing to it. And I think a lot of times we get caught up in the words. You know, you go to a restaurant, you don't eat the menu. You know,
certainly wouldn't be very satiated.
I don't think so. You know, but a lot of times we get caught up in these words and the language and the linguistics. You and I, we go back several years, and you know, I've traveled to where you've lived for, is it over 25 years in Rishikesh?
26 years,
amazing. And I remember hearing you speak about God and the names of God, and you I don't know if you remember how beautifully you put it. But if you could just tell us a little bit about the different names of God and why we have different names.
Sure. Let's say I love you. I do love you anyway.
Yeah, I love you too.
And let's say that I'm an eyes person, okay? Now, I love you. And so I go and I tell all my friends, he has got the most amazing eyes. When I look in his eyes, I see my soul. I see the soul of the universe. I see everything in his eyes. And if I were a poet or a songwriter, I would write poems and songs about your eyes. I would sculpt your eyes and paint your eyes. Now, someone else loves you, as so many do. And let's say that one of those people is a hand person and says, oh my God, he's got the best hands. They are strong, but they're soft, always ready to hold mine whenever I need it, to take my hand, to guide me, to give me energy. So that person's going to go and is going to describe your hands, write poems and songs and sonnets about your hands. Somebody else loves you, and they really need a shoulder to cry on these days. And so they're going to think about your shoulder and tell everyone how your shoulder is so broad and strong, but also soft and allows their head to be there. And they're going to write poems and songs and sonnets about your shoulders. Now, the three of us, me and the hand person and the shoulder person, all understand we love you. We are describing different aspects of you based on our own tendencies. The dilemma comes a few thousand years later. My descendants, or even a few hundred years later, my descendants think Prince EA was eyes. The other person's descendants think Prince EA was a hand. The third person's descendants think Prince EA is a shoulder. Now we fight and kill each other over it.
Wow.
Right? And this is the dilemma of what's happening these days.
Wow.
Is we've had all of these different amazing beings who have loved God and have described the divine in different ways. But we're all describing one aspect, one reflection, one embodiment, one manifestation of an infinite being.
That's beautiful. Yeah, it's so easy. When we intellectualize and we understand things that can't be understood with the mind, it can only be, it's only when we go the 7 inches from the head to the heart, as some say, the longest journey that we'll ever face in our lives. Speaking of journeys, there's a man passed. His name was Paul Brunton. Are you familiar with this guy?
Oh, Paul Brunton. Search of Secret India.
In Search of Secret India.
If anybody wants a book to read that just, I love.
Okay. I wasn't sure if you were familiar. Yes. So this book, I think 1930s or so on, it came out. And in this book, he talked about his journey in India. And one thing that was mentioned throughout was his interaction with gurus and yogis that had performed seemingly magical acts, things that modern science still has yet to recognize as real. I think one example was someone who they stopped their heart for a prolonged time. Mm-hmm. You have been in India for, as you say, 26 years. Have you come across any magical acts, experiences?
Of course.
Yeah.
But here's what's interesting. I think it was Albert Einstein. Mm-hmm. Who said there's two ways of looking at the world. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Either nothing is a miracle or everything is a miracle.
Yep.
To me, the fact that we wake up every morning.
Yes.
When we are in deep sleep.
Yeah.
You're in REM sleep. You're off somewhere. You're in London. You're in Paris. You're in, 20 years ago, 20 years hence, someplace that never existed. You're in the land of Oz.
Yep.
You're beyond the wardrobe, Narnia. I mean, you're anywhere. And yet, something brings you back.
Mm.
The fact that you can take junk, jujubes or liquor, I mean, whatever junk you want to put in your body, stick it in.
Mm-hmm.
And in the morning, you get up and this incredible thing that we call a body, but is actually this whirling, twirling energy system has actually taken out of your jujubes and licorice and lollipops and junk.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, it has taken out of that which may be useful and beneficial for the body and has sent all the rest out. And now you've excreted it.
Mm.
I mean, to me, that's magic and a miracle.
Totally.
But in terms of the stuff that Paul Brunton talked about, yes, I've seen a lot of it.
Yeah, like what?
My guru is a miracle worker on so many levels.
Mm.
But the way that he really manifests miracles is by manifesting exactly what you need in that moment.
Mm.
And I've just seen over and over again how, I'll give you an example.
Mm.
2004 tsunami happens.
Mm.
South Asia.
Mm-hmm.
We go from Rishikesh down to first Chennai and then into Tamil Nadu and then into Pondicherry.
Mm.
Devastation. I mean, everybody saw pictures of the tsunami.
Yeah.
Absolute devastation.
Mm.
So we get down there and we had no idea of actually how bad it was going to be.
Mm.
Nothing but rubble.
Yeah.
And women, mostly women, because most of those who were killed were men because the men were the fishermen. They were in the boats out in the water.
Mm.
Women sitting on rubble.
Mm.
Traumatized. Staring at the ocean. They haven't moved in 48 hours.
Wow.
Staring at the ocean, who they had worshipped as the divine. The ocean was for them the source of everything.
Mm.
The fish they ate, the livelihoods they had. Mm. In much of the world, oceanfront community is for the well-to-do.
Yeah.
In India, it's the fishing communities. So it wasn't so much resorts and hotels that were washed away as fishing communities. So anyway, these women are sitting on rubble. And we go down and realize that the very first thing they need is houses.
Hmm.
Temporary houses have to be built.
Hmm.
So we're standing in this big open field. Mm-hmm. My guru, Pujaswamiji, myself, a very good friend who's a famous actor in mm-hmm. India named Vivek Oberoi, mm-hmm. and five or six of our young boys, the Rishu Kumars, who mm-hmm. live at the ashram.
Yeah.
And we're standing down there talking mm-hmm. to the government head. Mm-hmm. about how we need to build temporary homes. The women need to change their clothes. They need to be able to cook food. They need to be able to lie down and rest. So he tells us that there's no official land allotment policy yet. The tsunami had only happened 2 days earlier, and the government had not yet figured out how they were going to allocate land for permanent reconstruction. So we say, no problem. We'll build temporary houses. These people were living in thatched huts before. We'll build them thatched huts again for now until we can build them proper cement structures. So the government guy says, well, where do you want to build it? So as I said, we're standing in this huge field. So we say, well, is this government property? And he says, yes. And we say, well, give it to us. We'll build them right here. So he says, okay. He calls their contractor, who tells us that he can fit, maybe it was 50, maybe it was 60 houses. So Pujaswamiji, my guru, says, we need at least 100. The guy says, 100? Swamiji says, yeah, easily. They don't need that much room between them, but we need 100 because there are so many people who need houses. 60 is not nearly enough. Fine. So the guy says, okay, it'll take me 2 weeks. So we were like, 2 weeks? These women have not laid down already in now almost 3 days. They need a place to change clothes. They need a place to bathe. They need to start cooking for themselves. What are we going to do? Swamiji says, 72 hours. You've got 72 hours. So the guy's like, the only way to do that is to bring in all these different teams. I'm going to need lots of teams of laborers working simultaneously. And he says, and I'm going to need 50% of the money up front. I don't know you people. Fine. Now, as Swamiji's negotiating this with the contractor, I turn to Vivek and the Rishi Kumars, and I'm like, how much money do you guys have? Because I've got the equivalent of maybe $50 or $60. Between us, we ended up with a couple hundred. Now, because the tsunami had just happened, all of the banks, ATMs, I mean, nothing was functional. Eventually, we would get money from Rishikesh, where we're from, but it wasn't going to happen by sunset. And Swamiji's just told the contractor that, yes, you come to us at sunset and we will give you 50%, which was thousands of dollars. And so I think, okay, I mean, clearly there must be some way that he knows this is going to happen. And in the afternoon, we're sitting in our makeshift office, just kind of a metal ceiling, essentially, roof to block out the sun and some plastic chairs and whatnot. And I see in the distance this cloud of sand. Because remember, after the tsunami, everything had feet of sand over it. And it was a car coming. And whenever a car came, it was driving over the sand. So you would see all the sand, you know, coming up. The car parks not too far from where we are. And out of it walk these two people, a man and a woman, toward us. And I can tell the man is a Sikh. He's wearing a turban. And as they get closer, I recognize them as very close, beautiful devotees of the ashram. And I'm thinking, what are they doing here? Like, how did they get here? We are in the southernmost part of India. They had gone to Rishikesh, to Parmarthnikadhan. And he comes in and they sit down. He says, yeah, you know, we had gone to the ashram to celebrate New Year's. But they told us that you people were down here doing tsunami work. So we thought, let us come. We talk for a few minutes and the man reaches into his bag and he pulls out an envelope. And it's stapled shut, and it's about this thick. And he says, here is a donation that I was going to give at the ashram for the new year. But since you're doing this work, I thought, let me give it here. To the rupee, It was exactly to the rupee. It was what we had to give the guy that evening. I didn't have to open a staple.
Stop it.
He had manifested a devotee to travel across the country.
He knew.
And hand us an envelope of cash. Huh.
Wow.
3 hours before we had to hand it to a contractor.
Yeah. Yeah.
So things like that happen all the time.
Yeah.
All the time.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Dang. How you feeling?
I'm feeling great.
You feeling great?
Sweaty and hot.
Another hour in here would be good. No, I'm just kidding. You ready to step out, get some cold air, some refreshments? And
sure.
Yeah?
All sure.
Right. Awesome. The hydration session coming right now. So, Savi, how was that? How was the sauna?
It was beautiful.
Yeah?
Being with you in general is beautiful. And being with you in that new way was really beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. We've never done a sauna together.
Never.
We've met each other in many different cities, countries, places, but not a sauna yet. Well, then there you go. Next is a night. Well, okay. You know, you're not a fan of the ice baths.
I've never done it.
Okay.
I've never done it.
Okay. Okay.
I might be open to it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I don't know if I'm open.
I would.
To it.
I would
tough.
Rather. I would rather just jump into Ganga.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which we do all the time anyway, which is not icy, but she's fed by the glacier.
Mm.
So it's glacial water coming down. And it's sacred and holy and liberating and transformative.
Wow. You get in every day?
Not every day.
Okay.
As much as I can, as frequently as I can. Sometimes in the winter, it's just really cold. So,
yeah.
Not so much cold in the water, but cold out.
Gotcha. You said not every day. Do you have a morning routine?
Oh, yeah. Well, the very first thing I do before I even get out of bed is my gratitude practice.
Great.
And I actually do it from bed for a reason. Because the minute you get up, the mind suddenly starts going with all of the things that you have to do. Before I even go there, I want the fullness of my day to be anchored and grounded only in gratitude. So I lie in bed and I think of at least five things that I am really grateful for.
Awesome. Different every day?
Not always.
Okay.
A lot of days I'm grateful for the same things.
Yeah.
And that's fine. And I mean, and that goes back to this, like, you know, tight ship runner, authoritarian, spiritual dictator who says it has to be five different things every day. Well, why?
Yeah. Is it always five, though? Or is it three? Is it four? Or
it's a five minimum.
Okay.
There are definitely days where more than five flow and flood. But yeah, I make sure there's at least five.
Beautiful.
And I do try to create space for newness and creativity. But I'm not a hardcore authoritarian who says, you said that yesterday.
Yeah.
So I loved you yesterday.
Yeah.
I can't love you again today.
Exactly.
The tree outside my window was there yesterday. It's there today.
Yeah, true.
So gratitude practice first.
I'm the same way. Like when I'm waking up out of bed, first thing is gratitude. And I thank my heart for beating throughout the night, you know. So it's so important to wake up with gratitude.
Thank you for waking me.
Yeah.
Thank you for waking me. You know, you asked, is it sometimes three? Well, even if I can't think of anything else, did my eyes actually open and can I see out of them? Do my legs work to carry me into the bathroom where I need to go as soon as I'm done with this gratitude practice? Is there running water coming out of my tap in the bathroom where at will I can turn it on and actually have water? Is there food in a fridge, in a cupboard, in a kitchen? Is there someone in the bed, in the room, in the house, in the universe I love and who loves me? I mean, these are the basics. If you can't think of anything to be grateful for, well, I've just given you five, six right there. If you can check yes to those, did you wake up in a country where you are free to worship the divine by whatever name, whatever form, whatever way you want, or not to worship at all, or not even to believe at all? Do you have that freedom? Do you have the freedom to love whomever you want in whatever way you want? If you check yes to those 6, 7, 8 things, you're more blessed than, you're more fortunate than 99% of people on the planet. So even if there's nothing unique to your life that you can think of, I can always come up with at least 5.
Awesome.
So, yeah. And then I drink warm water. I don't, you asked me earlier about lemon water, which I do, but I do that actually after my meditation practice. And it's just for a purely pragmatic reason, which is I've noticed the lemon water makes me do a little bit of, it brings a little bit more saliva in my mouth. That when I'm doing pranayama and meditation is just there. And I find I'd rather have plain water first. I then do my practice of pranayama.
Breath work.
Breath work of chanting what we call japa. It's a recitation of a mantra. And then meditation. And the three really flow very easily, one right into the other. And then I, if it's the summertime, I will do my yoga, my asana practice then. If it's winter time, I do that later in the day just because it's so cold in the winter. And it always takes a little while for the body to warm up. We don't have central heating. I don't like space heaters. I avoid heaters altogether So it just takes a little bit longer for the body to warm up in the winter.
Get you a sauna, you know?
And then, and then I come into my office and oh, and I obviously have a shower before all of that. I bathe before that. And then I start the day of of service in a variety of different ways. And of course, we have our morning fire ceremony at the ashram that we all gather together for a sacred fire ceremony.
What time do you get up?
I get up really early. I get up between 4 and 5. Depending on the season. My alarm goes off at 4:15. There are many days in the summertime when I'm up before it, and there's many days in the winter where I find myself hitting the snooze a few times.
But, we all do
but yeah, sometime before 5 I'm out of bed.
I love what you said about the balance between the discipline and the flow, right? Like, it's so important. I remember Osho spoke about how meditation itself, it shouldn't be mechanical. And I think a lot of times in our world today, it's regimented, like a military operation.
And you get nothing out of it then.
You lose the aliveness, and which is what
that's the whole point. I mean, could you imagine? I always go back to our life. Imagine your beloved. Now imagine that you come home from work and you say, and you've got a list in front of you, and you say, okay, so first we hug, 20 seconds, go. And you set and you set a stopwatch and you hug for 20 seconds. Then the thing beeps and you say, okay, now we're done. Now we kiss 10 seconds and you set the thing. I mean, would you enjoy that? You lose the aliveness. You lose that sense of deep flow. Meditation is connecting you with the truth of who you are. And that's why I keep going back to the loved one, because it is a reconnection with this being of love, the capital L love of you. And whether we talk about God or the divine or source or spirit or again, whatever word we use, it doesn't matter. The universe, creation, that experience of being in love. I mean, I am just so in love with the universe and with creation and with the leaves and the trees. And so the last thing that I want is to be all up in my head and regimented, as you said, about it. You want it to be able to flow. So, yes, you have to do it. And there should be, in my opinion, flexibility. Yeah. Now, that being said, there are days in which I've got a particular type of meditation that I do every once in a while.
Okay.
And it's not the type that I do normally.
Okay.
Normally, I do a meditation of an anchoring in my breath and a chanting of my mantra, which are vehicles, you could say, that take me into an experience of borderless and boundaryless oneness. And when I lose that, then again, I use the technique of that awareness of the breath and the conscious recitation of the mantra. But every once in a while, I will do a meditation on the physical body and awareness of it. So, for example, what I notice is I tend to change the cross of my legs, usually after about 40, 45 minutes or so. That tends to be approximately when my body just naturally wants to change the cross of its legs when I'm sitting. And normally I don't pay any attention to it. It happens just naturally. But every once in a while, I'll do a meditation in which I will actually set an alarm, sometimes an hour, sometimes an hour and 15 minutes, in which the rule is until that alarm goes, you don't budge. Not a scratch on the nose, not a changing of the legs. You don't budge. And it's a very different type of meditation because it began when I first got to the ashram. They've got these morning prayers every day at 5. And when I first came, it used to be compulsory. It no longer is compulsory, but it used to be. And you'd sit in the hall, and sometimes it was so crowded that I'm surrounded by ladies, you know, everywhere, and there was no space to change the cross of your legs. And it lasted an hour, and I was not used to sitting on the floor. I had no practice sitting on the floor, sitting cross-legged for so long. And after some time, my knee and my hip would start hurting. And initially, I would just try to distract myself. But of course, the more you try to distract yourself, the more it hurts. And I then developed a practice, a technique, where I decided, all right, that pain is just going to be my meditation. And I just started going into it. Where instead of trying to do something else, I dove into it. It was not a gentle witnessing, just awareness. It was literally me playing games with it. I would go in and I would say, is that all you got? Like, really?
Come on. That's cool.
Come on. Give me your best shot. Like, I'm still here. I haven't budged. I haven't screamed. I haven't straightened out my leg, kicking the lady in front of me. I'm still here. Come on. Can't ever, you get any hotter?
Does it ever respond back to you? Like, okay.
And no. Interesting what I noticed was that gentle paying of attention to it. And the taunting is loving. It's not, it's, you know, I don't really have that competitive streak in me. But just the attention actually made it hurt a lot less than when I tried to distract myself. And it became a technique that I use now for so much in life. Physical pain, mental pain, emotional pain, is it's not about, oh, I'm going to distract myself. It's about a deep dive into it. Not in a way where I'm going to rehearse it and squeeze it for, milk it for all it's got. But just, I'm going to deep dive and be there. And so I sometimes do a meditation practice of just to give myself that skill again, the muscle of just sitting in the presence of a knee, a hip, an ankle that starts to pain, that gets hot, that starts to scream, change the cross of your leg, move me, and to just love it through it, not to ignore it. I don't taunt it so much anymore, but now I just love it.
Got it.
All right, here we are. That's the only time where for me it's a regimented of here's how long I'm going to sit and there's an alarm that goes.
Okay. I love that. Yeah, somebody said if a dog is chasing you, call for it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Come here. Absolutely. Absolutely. Give it love.
Yeah. You watch Netflix at all? Are you saying? Okay. So on Netflix.
We don't have TVs.
You know, okay. Yeah. There have been documentaries about, you could say, a fall from grace in the guru world.
Yeah.
One I think I saw a year ago was hot yoga, Bikram yoga. Mm. I didn't look too much into it, but there's a phenomenon that happens.
Yeah.
You know, the guru may form a relationship with a disciple. A mess happens.
Yeah.
What's your take on all of this?
So I think there's a lot of different pieces to it. I think there's a lot of different reasons that things happen. One of them, and perhaps is the most common, is people become leaders, gurus, which I purposely put in quotation marks because the word guru literally means the one who removes the darkness and brings the light.
Mm, the one who removes the darkness and
brings the light.
Wow.
But here's the kicker. The light that the guru shines is not a light on himself or herself.
Mm.
It's a light on you. The guru is the one who removes your darkness of ignorance in which you can't see, and shines the light so that you can see the truth of you. Now, a lot of those who have fallen from grace, I don't think were actually ever really gurus to begin with.
Mm.
I think what happens a lot is you have beings who probably in most cases, they were well-intentioned to begin with. They had a skill. They had a spiritual experience. They had an awareness. They had an understanding. They wanted to share. Maybe they have a very charismatic personality. Maybe they have a very attractive physique. Maybe they have something else that draws people to them. Adoration can be a drug. And I think when you don't have a foundation of real deep spiritual practice, when you don't have a foundation of awareness that everything is grace, it's not about you, all of us. That which we are able to do, achieve, share, be, is because we are instruments in the hands of the divine. Right? I mean, this microphone is enabling your beautiful community all over the world to hear us. But if at the end of this, the microphone said, oh my God, wasn't I so great? Like stood up and took a bow and said, okay, everybody, you know, clap for me. You laugh because you realize, well, the microphone's only an instrument. We are the ones speaking. But I would say to you in the same way, we are only instruments. We are using the microphone to say that which needs to be said. We are being used by the divine, by grace, by cosmic intelligence, by whatever you call it. And so if I don't realize that, and if I start to think, oh my God, I'm so great. I'm so smart. I'm so wise. I'm so this. I'm so that. That adoration is a drug. It blinds you. It cripples you. It's insidious. And it's a virus. It doesn't just intoxicate you, but it actually ends up bringing toxicity to the lives of all of those around you, because it becomes all about you. And so I think what ends up happening a lot is you have people who have beautiful, authentic teachings, awarenesses, realizations, but who haven't really done the level of personal spiritual practice to make them realize it's all the divine. I'm an instrument, like St. Francis of Assisi, right? Oh, Lord, you know, make me an instrument of thy grace. Not make me the bringer of it all. Make me an instrument. So I think that happens a lot.
That recognition that we are instruments is rare. Would you say so?
It's rare, but it's critical.
Because the ego has such a gravitational pull.
Of course it does. But this is why our spiritual practice is there, because it's rare, but it is critical, not only if you want to be a guru, it's critical if you want to be happy in the world at all. Mm-hmm. Moving through the world feeling like it's all up to me, it's all about me, that's toxicity.
Yeah. Wow.
In your peace, in your joy, in your life. I mean, for me, I know I spent the first 25 years of my life before I went to India thinking it's all about me. I was far from a guru. I was a PhD student. I had I didn't even know what the word guru meant. I had never heard the word. I was a student. But I certainly thought life was all about me. It's the culture that we're born and raised in. As you know, I am from here in LA. And it's a culture that tells us, be number one, be the top. You've got to do it. It's all about you. And, you know, pull yourself up, an individualistic culture. And it teaches us to be so identified with our stories. With that which we've done, because it is all about me, with that which has happened to me, because even if you did it to me, it's still all about me, because that's what my ego thinks. And that's why, you know, spiritually and psychologically, we always teach people, it's not about you. You know, everybody's just got their own karmic package they're working through. Everybody's got their own toolkit that they're moving through the world with. And it's not all about you. But that's how so many of us think. And I know for me, I had always thought it was all about me. I had identified so much with my story. The blessings, the grace of it, the privilege, the opportunity, the love that I had been given. And also the trauma, the abuse, the abandonment, the addiction, the eating disorder. I mean, all of that story of how I suffered, the depression, the anxiety, it felt all about me. And that it was all about me to overcome it. It was all up to me. And so I moved through this world with this real sense of me, 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 me. And it ruins your life. So realizing that we are just an instrument, a vehicle, a vessel in the hands of nature. I mean, you look at nature, you look at this beautiful tree. Well, the tree blossoms. There's an intelligence in nature that makes that tree know, I give apples, I give oranges, I'm a rose bush, I give fragrance. There's just that intelligence in the universe. We don't have to feel like it's all about us. So for me, that was one of the greatest teachings of being in India, of this spiritual opening and experience and transformation was get out of your story, get out of your drama. Don't deny it or push it away. Don't repress it or suppress it, but just realize that isn't you.
Yeah. It seems like many of these cases kind of revolve around something to do with sex. Sex is a very powerful energy. That's why we're all here, very primal. How do you transcend sexual desires or urges, or does it dissolve?
Great question. Through
meditation?
Great question. First of all, unless you are a celibate monastic like I am, there's nothing wrong with sex. There's nothing that says sex and spirituality cannot coexist. There's nothing in the scriptures or the teachings that says thou shalt become celibate. Yes, for some of us, it is our dharma to live a monastic life. But for many people, it's not. And in fact, there's so many stories. Most of the sages and the rishis and the yogis were actually householders. Mm-hmm. So it's really important to begin with that, that there's no spiritual hierarchy that mm-hmm. says, oh, if you're celibate, you are more spiritual or better
yeah.
than someone who's not.
Okay.
That being said, sexual energy is just an energy. It comes mostly biologically. We can all look back on our lives and remember when that energy started. Even people who are not on spiritual monastic paths, women notice when they go through menopause, the energy in many, many cases becomes less. Because a lot of that energy is biological, biochemical. Mm-hmm. There are hormones flooding through our bodies that are saying, make babies, make babies, mm-hmm. make babies. And that's how our species procreated. We are the children mm-hmm. of those who had the urges mm-hmm. to make babies. Mm-hmm. So we're very glad for that. The way to work with it is, first of all, to realize it is just an energy.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a biochemical thing happening in my body. Mm. It's not a master that I have to obey. Mm. It's just something to be aware of. I think the problem comes when we try to repress it or suppress
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
I think the other main problem comes is when we shame it.
Mm.
So for me, I feel really lucky because I've gone through, you could call it kind of three steps on my path of celibacy. First was the first 25 years of my life in which I was not celibate, not abstaining. I had no idea that that would even be something one would want to abstain from. I then get to India at 25, have this incredibly powerful experience of transformation on the banks of the Ganga River that you know about. Mm. And at that time, celibacy just happened to me. It was such a powerful spiritual transformation that I was so full, so bubbling literally inside with spiritual ecstasy and presence, with the juice literally of spirituality, of the presence of God, that the desire for anything that used to be a part of my life, from sex to bagels and everything in between, things that I used to really like and used to engage in or enjoy, the desire for them just dissipated. It felt like the universe came through me with a vacuum cleaner, one of those little dustbusters, or a vacuum cleaner with one of the long things, and just sucked up from within me all of that that wasn't going to be conducive to the life that I was living.
Mm.
But then, a few years later, in a story that I won't go into here for lack of time, but it is there in Hollywood to the Himalayas, I suddenly, 3-4 years after I took official vows of renunciation, found myself flooded with desire, and desire for a very specific person. There is a specific energetic thing happening. Because I don't come from a worldview and a culture in which that is shameful, and because even though I had made a conscious decision to take a vow of celibacy, I never had a sense of sex is bad or sexual desire is bad. I mean, there was never a sense from me of I shouldn't feel that.
Yeah.
I was able to go to my guru and say, I've got a problem here.
Uh-huh, wow.
Which I did.
Yeah.
But I feel incredibly blessed, A, to have a mindset in which I didn't feel shameful about it. I felt a little embarrassed to talk to my guru about sexual desire. But there was no sense of there's something wrong with me.
Wow, that's great.
In the same way that you would be embarrassed to talk to like a teacher you really respected or, you know, an elder you really respected. I had that level of kind of a little bit of embarrassment, but I felt really comfortable saying, I've taken this vow. I do not want to break the vow. And I'm really struggling. I feel very sad for those monastics who don't come from a culture and a mindset in which they feel very comfortable in accepting the fact that this is a very normal and natural thing to feel. It doesn't mean you have to act on it, but the feeling of it is normal and natural and beautiful even. And who don't have gurus who are open to that honesty. I mean, I think in so many places that would be a cause for shame. And so they don't go and they don't admit it. And I think they probably try their hardest not to give in. But as anyone who's ever been in a situation of saying, you know, okay, from now on, we're just going to be friends, right? You know what I mean? You say, all right, now, from now on, we're just friends.
Yeah.
And then you realize, oh, okay, that wasn't supposed to happen. And then you say, okay, from now on, we're just going to be friends. We all know that overcoming sexual desire is not very easy, especially in the moment. And I think that there are our monastics who have very good intentions, very right intentions, but who are overcome with normal human feelings. They don't have a place they can go. They don't necessarily have access to wisdom about practices to really overcome that. Because what my guru gave me were specific practices, energetic, meditative ways of, you know, as I said, it's just energy.
Energy, yeah.
And what he taught me how to do was not to push it away, not to deny it or repress it, but simply to raise it.
Okay.
Can you allow the energy, embrace, accept the energy, but simply raise it up?
Wow.
Can you bring it into your heart? Because really, sexual energy is an energy of, I want to go from 2 to 1.
That's good. Yeah.
Here we are sitting here as 2. If there were sexual desire, it would be a desire for 2 to become 1. Well, if I can bring that out of my genitals and into my heart, then it becomes this extraordinary energy of oneness with all, oneness with the creation. Then you open your eyes from that meditation and it's like, oh my God, the tree. Oh my God, the universe.
This is a tantric practice.
Tantra is a system, a powerful system of working with a variety of different energies. There are aspects of Tantra that absolutely work with the energies in this way. I'm not sure if this particular practice exactly as it is. Falls into it. It wouldn't surprise me if it does. It was not presented to me as in, now I'm going to give you a tantric practice. From my understanding of Tantra, a lot of it actually has to do with going into the places that we normally don't spiritually, but staying anchored and grounded in spirit and in God. This was a practice of, I am not going into a physical coupling situation. It's me.
Sure. Yeah.
Me and myself and I sitting in my temple, in my room, cross-legged, simply allowing the energy to rise.
Okay.
And bringing it very consciously into my heart and allowing that energy of union to become an energy of ecstasy at how one I am with the planet. And it became literally this, oh my God, oh my God.
Yeah.
isn't the universe so beautiful?
Oh, beautiful.
And isn't the creation so beautiful?
Mm. Yeah, it sounds, because my understanding of Tantra, it's another word. The map is not the territory.
Yes.
It's just a path, a way to get to that oneness.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So you mentioned your book, From Hollywood to the Himalayas. My perception of you, and like I said, I've known you for many years, you're able to humanize spirituality. And I think it's so important to do that, because so many of us believe that even I, you know, many years ago, I always thought, let me get my career right first and then I'll learn about God or go to God. But you actually say that God is not in the mountains. God is here, right here, right now, inside all of us. So, and around all of us. That's the beauty of being infinite.
Yeah.
There's no limitations.
Yeah.
So this book is your story. And where can people go to pick it up if they want to read it?
First of all, everybody should know that our beloved Princier wrote the foreword to it. Mm-hmm. People can get it anywhere. They can get it on Amazon. They can get it at their local bookstores. If their local bookstores don't have it, tell them to order it. It's my story, literally, Hollywood to the Himalayas via Stanford University in Palo Alto.
Wow.
It's the story of how I traveled to India at 25 with a backpack on what I thought was a semester break from my PhD program. Mm. The story of how I had everything.
Mm.
And if you looked at me from the outside, you would have said, this girl has it all.
Mm.
Degree from Stanford, getting her PhD, comes from a beautiful family with so much opportunity, so much privilege, so many blessings. And yet, how I suffered on the inside.
Wow.
How I suffered with the identification as the one who was abused, the one who was abandoned, as I suffered as in the midst of my eating disorder, in the midst of the depression and the addiction, and how when I got to India on what I thought was just going to be a few month adventure, I had this incredible experience standing on the banks of this sacred river, and then how I was told, instructed, shown how to let go of the pain.
Mm.
To let go of that identification and to be free. I always say it's the agony and the ecstasy of a spiritual life. It's what is it like to be celibate?
Mm.
What is it like to be a monastic? What is it like to be a woman in essentially a man's world of religion?
Yeah.
What is it like to be an American raised in a Jewish family in the midst of religious India, and the ecstasy of the ecstatic experiences. Mm-hmm. I try to put words on experiences that have no words.
No words, yeah.
And to really bring the reader into what is it like to have an experience of absolute ecstasy, an absolute union with the divine, that samadhi experience or nirvana experience or whatever you call it. And how I was able to let go and to find that freedom and to heal and transform. Mm. But my favorite part of the book actually is not just my story, which as you know is fun and funny and amazing in all of those ways, but is how everyone, regardless of where they are, can actually make that shift. That's what inspired me to write the book was not just, oh, let me share this incredible experience with everybody that, as everyone says, reads like a great novel that just happens to be true. But how the reader can take what I've learned and even without physically shifting their location from Hollywood to the Himalayas, how they can shift their mindset from the Hollywood way of thinking to the Himalayan way of thinking. Awesome. The Hollywood way of thinking says you are your body.
Yeah.
Its size, its shape, its color, its career, its bank account, its followers on Instagram, like you are that. And so we suffer. We suffer. There's a sense of not enoughness. There's a sense of competition. There's a sense of lack. There's jealousy. There's all of that. And the Himalayan way of thinking says you have a body, but you're not the body.
Yes.
You are soul. You are spirit. You are consciousness. You are love. You are divinity. And when we make that mindset shift, we find an end to suffering. And so that's my favorite part of the book is that even though, yes, it was my dharma to physically go from Hollywood to the Himalayas, wherever people are, they can make that mindset shift and they can find that healing and transformation that I found.
Beautiful.
And they don't have to become celibate and they don't have to wear only orange robes and live in the Himalayas. And,
but if they wanted to go to the Himalayas, you're there.
I am there.
Paramahansa Niketan. They can visit you in Rishikesh.
Of course. Okay. Of course. Yes, we are in the lap of the Himalayas, as you know, on the banks of the sacred Ganga, the Ganges River, in a beautiful place called Rishikesh. The name of our ashram is Paramarth Niketan. It literally means an abode dedicated to the welfare of all.
Beautiful.
And yeah, people can just send an email and come. And we have our beautiful International Yoga Festival that we do every year in March, from the 8th to the 14th of March. Hoping you're going to join us there again this year. And all 52 weeks a year are beautiful there, and people can just send an email and come and visit.
Awesome. Savi, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your heart.
I love you so much. And thank you so much for using your amazing energy of influence and impact to bring people deeper. To really take people on their deep dive of how to find that sense of truth and opening and blossoming within their own hearts and their own lives. It's so beautiful.
Thank you so much.
I love you so much.
Love you.